team did.
Some you there, peasant, pay for my things.
Go and procure for me sponsorship.
Comes down and goes, yes, sir, Joe. And he buys some coins.
You wish you had minions.
I do wish I had minions.
I guess you do.
Well,
you have one minion singular.
One minion. Working on my empire here. Welcome to the Backpack Show.
It's off to a great start.
Business insights from unusual places. We'll talk about success and more with Margot Bloomstein or Bloomstein, either one you want, and Joe Polizzi.
And if you haven't noticed, we are sponsored.
Yeah.
By Joe Polizzi.
Have we got a sponsor today? You know, really the first of anything like that. And, you know, it's a sponsored episode in some ways. don't feel especially weird about it. I mean, it's just regular normal here. But no, we're going to talk to two authors. Joe has decided to go back and write again the book Content Inc. That's what all the kids are doing these days. You add a few more pages, put it back out. More money for the same book. That's perfect.
Is that what you did?
Well, that's what I did with Trust Agents. 10th edition, baby. Woo!
Is that what you did, Chris?
You know, we had to do with Trust Agents 10th edition? We basically had to delete all the things like how to get on the front page of Dig. Oh, what a bunch of idiots. Who wrote a book with technology in it? Worst idea ever.
Margo's is about trust, so it should be perfect. Her book is called Trustworthy: How the Smartest Brands Beat Cynicism and Bridge the Trust Gap.
And it's very appropriate that we have Margo on at the same episode. Let's just call that what it is. It's very appropriate.
Welcome to the Backpack Show with your hosts, Chris Brogan and Kerry Gargone. Boom shakalaka.
You know, it's not a backpack show if I don't laugh already till I cry.
I know. And then you have to kind of like touch up a little, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Something happens. Well, welcome.
I know.
So glad to have everybody here on the old Backpack Show.
So funny.
No, I mean, but looks aren't everything. But you know what? I also have to show you.
No, I never know what you're doing over there.
I have my Johnsonville shirt on. So,
oh, nice. Former sponsor, Johnsonville Sausage.
Former sponsor, Johnsonville Sausage, who we got as a sponsor by sheer willpower.
You did.
I had these delicious Johnsonville brats, and I said, man, I forgot how delicious these were. And someone on their Twitter account was like, that's great. You know, we'd love to send you some crap. And they sent me like a bunch of t-shirts and things. I was like, well, that's great, but I want a real sponsorship. And we made it happen. So we got thousands of dollars worth of meat products to send to nuns and others.
That was the first thing I thought of. So I thought Johnsonville Sausage is going to help me send sausage to Sister Anne Flanagan of the Daughters of St. Paul. I would have sent them so much sausage so they could do, because she had come on the show and said that she cooked for the convent sometimes and had to use donated food. So she'd have to figure out something to make with, like, you know, what if she had some really weird flavor stuff?
Oh, she had some crazy things, like, you know, something with a pesto.
Oh, like cilantro pesto. Yeah, like weird. And calamari or something.
Nobody wants that.
And we were like, come on. So she did pizza with the Johnsonville sausage, and it was a great big hit. So
delicious.
I consider that a success all around.
So I don't know. I've been debating back and forth.
I mean,
who I'm going to put on first.
She was sponsored, so you're going to have to put him on. But I think he would defer because he's nice.
Well, I also have to know about these brats later, so maybe I'll have to bring Margo out first now.
Ask about the brats.
But I have to ask her about this. So, ready? Margo, who's an Usinger or Usinger or something? What are we on about here?
Yeah, Usinger's brats. I could not let that go. Johnsonville is excellent, in part, I think, because they're available. You can get them lots of places. Like, I don't live in Wisconsin. I live in Massachusetts, and we have access to Johnsonville here. But we have family in Wisconsin, which is the land of Usinger's brats, which are hands down amazing. But I will say, all brats are good brats, but these are really, really good brats.
Now, but do they stuff cheddar into them? Because come on.
No, but I feel like Wisconsin, you're always like in a cheese adjacent experience, cheese adjacent state of mind. So you can make the cheddar happen.
You know, by the way, that should be a really great catch quote.
Cheese adjacent.
Oh, you can make the cheddar happen. I think that's a great t-shirt.
Yeah, like that. That's Wisconsin in a nutshell there. Make the cheddar happen.
Absolutely. So it's appropriate you're on. We wanted to talk to you a little bit about what's going on with the book, but we also want to talk about you and get a sense of what you've been doing and where you've been doing it. So
in Wisconsin, cheese adjacent.
She's in Massachusetts, the food. Yeah. But tell me, you know, what have you been doing with the business? You've worked with all these great people like Al Jazeera, I think was one of them. And sorting out all these brands like Lint. You know, think about
it. Did you say Al Jazeera is a person?
Like, no, all these cool people. Like Al Jazeera. Turns out there's humans inside of AJ and Lint and Timberland. I mean, you have those are some banging logos. What have you been doing for these people? How do you make them feel more appropriate?
Well, I think across all those different organizations, I'm always the person in the room saying, all right, well, how are you going to make your content appropriate for your brand? Not what your competitors are doing, but appropriate for your voice and your publishing culture, what your people can maintain. And write for your target audience too, and what they're actually interested in, and working that out, figuring out their message architecture or their hierarchy of communication goals. That's the thing that I do. That's the thing that I've done with every client over the past 20 years, whether they make chocolate truffles or construction boots or news media. That's kind of the common thread.
Pretend I've just landed on this planet. What does message architecture mean?
It is the hierarchy or priority of communication goals. So what you want to make sure comes through in every interaction, every experience with your audience. You always want them to know whether they're first engaging with you on Twitter or opening up a package of sausage. All right, this is the brand that is always consistent or reliable or fun or quirky. What is the most important thing? And then what's the next most important thing? And then after that. Is that the right answer for the right now? In the world? Yeah. You're an alien with a special interest in marketing. So where do you start?
I mean, Lord only knows, but I was curious because the language of that was, I was just sort of thinking, well, how does anybody know? Like, that must be a very long meeting, even just to, you know, like when you say, what do you guys think your brand architecture is? Do they all just like smile politely at you?
I find there's a lot of, well, we want to be modern. And I'm always thinking like, well, who doesn't? Right. And how does that differ from what you've always been doing? So one of the tools that I developed, I guess going back about 10 years ago now, to get at that is to facilitate a message architecture exercise. And I developed a tool called Brand Sort, which is a deck of about 90 cards and the process around it to facilitate that conversation. Because yeah, I think everybody wants to be modern or innovative or smart, but I want to figure out, well, do they want to be smart or wise or savvy? Do those words have weird connotations in their organization? Or do people get kind of like a little bit tweaked out when they hear some of them and think, well, that's really one of our competitors? So that's what I'm trying to get at through that process.
You sold out of your Brand Sort cards. What the hell?
Yeah. Yeah. When are they sold back? Out of the Brand Sort cards because I was focused on the book.
Somebody.
That's what everybody hopes for. Oh, you had to like write more of them or something.
Yeah, yeah. Good problem to have. Need to come up with new adjectives.
Well, maybe you could get that sorted out. I'm just gonna keep doing.
I feel like you almost deserve a yellow card. That is a bad.
Boom shakalaka. Yellow card. Brogan. And Brogan is going down like a bag of hammers tonight.
I mean, it was on the edge, so I just tipped it over.
It's fair.
You know. Right. That's what I thought.
So let's talk about the new book for a second. You have a book called Trustworthy, talking about how big brands could be poop heads and maybe how not to communicate like a poop head.
That's not the title.
It's sort of something like that. I don't know. Subtitles are hard. How the smartest brands beat cynicism and bridge the trust gap. Let's say, for example, you're a trillionaire, the first trillionaire in the world, and you have a website that dwarfs all these other sites, but we have to be really nice to them because we all sell books on them. Hey, look, they are right there. How do you help a brand like that make its way through this mess? Like, for instance, I think 2020 was a great moment of sort of realizing that a lot of our gods we shouldn't be praising. You know, we found a lot of false idols this past year. And suddenly people like Ellen are like, oh, never mind, I'll leave. And James Corden goes, "Ooh, well, I guess I'm done." And like a whole bunch of people just kind of left. But brands are also running into this. They're getting smashed around. So how does that translate to what you've got in Trustworthy? And how does it translate into what you advocate?
Well, I think what we've seen over the past year, over the past couple years, is that more and more consumers expect more from the brands in their lives. I don't want to say like we want relationships with the company that makes our dishwasher detergent. But at the same time, I think we do expect that if we're going to give an organization money for whatever kind of product or service or ongoing kind of experience, that we want them to behave in a way that is not abusive, that is not destructive or disrespectful, or that undermines the other things that we value. And I think that as people have kind of come to expect more from organizations, and they've seen how some organizations have responded, maybe by making their values visible or getting more political or engaging on political issues, I think that has become sort of a cycle where, all right, we're seeing brands respond to our needs and our demands. And so we're expecting that now from more and more organizations, because you don't just have to do business with the only game in town, the only player in town in whatever industry. You can take your dollars elsewhere, vote with your dollars elsewhere. So I think that we're expecting more from brands and speakers and organizations.
One of the things you talk about, Margo, is the Whisper Network. Can we talk about what that is? I mean, I know what it was in elementary school when I got in big trouble for passing notes in the fourth grade, but I think you're talking about something entirely different.
Yeah, I think as we've talked about that term, I've seen it used in a few different contexts. One is when people are deciding where they want to take their time and talent and skill and where they want to work. And I think for many of us in certain industries, we do have a little bit more freedom to say, well, I'm going to choose who my clients are, or I'm going to choose who my colleagues are, or where I want to do business. And then we start to dig a little bit to find out, like, does this company live up to their stated vision and values? Do their values align with mine? And sometimes you hear in the back channel, people do talk and say, you know what, those values are not going to be coinciding with your values, or here's what really happens behind the scenes there. Or maybe they've made a big play around hashtag Me Too, or making a big play around their commitment to diversity, but they're not really continuing to invest in that. They're not doing the work to improve what's inside their company the same way they want to improve what's outside their company. And I think potential employees have those discussions. I think consumers also have those discussions to say, yeah, the brand is known for this. They've put out the right kind of ads. They've sponsored the right events. Everybody's holding a banner in the pride parades. But this is what the organization is really like. And right. I think that those whispers are becoming a lot louder because of social media. They're not really so back channel anymore. And I think for any organization to think that they can act in a way that doesn't align with their stated values is really dated thinking.
There's a brand I thought of right away when you were talking about this was Burger King. And one day I watched this great ad about anti-bullying, and I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. Good for you, Burger King. And they had this kind of thing where they punch the crap out of a Whopper and then hand it to someone. And this is their way of explaining how, you know, bullying or violence or whatever happens. It was weird. But like another week or two later, they're onto some other cause. And then they were in another cause. And I was sort of like, which one of these do you want, Burger King? You can't have eight causes. Like, you know, we're not going to work that well with that. And it really just started to seem like, you know, well, I don't know, whatever's going to get us some attention. And clearly that's not going to work so well.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think one of the issues around brands making their values visible is that, all right, now they've attracted attention and that's going to attract some scrutiny and they may mess up, but people are also going to expect some continuity in their message. It kind of goes back to the message architecture thing, where when a brand says what they stand for, people expect them to uphold it. And that's kind of a cornerstone of content strategy, of being able to maintain and sustain a message over time, regardless of who the content creator is. I think that's also just part and parcel of good branding. Good branding is sustainable branding, where your audience can run with the message because they know what that message is. But you're right. I think when organizations start throwing their attention and their dollars around a lot of disparate efforts and causes, their audience doesn't know what to make from that. I think the way they get past that is really by authentically tying it back to who they are. So an organization like a brand like Burger King that says, we're here for cheap family meals, where you know it's a limited menu, you know what you're going to get, and it's going to be decent value for the money. Okay, let's make all of your causes then around maybe food security or something like that. There are a lot of issues around food and hunger and nutrition, and those all kind of relate to each other. And that's a much more, I don't know, I don't want to get the yellow card on this, but it's a more palatable.
We don't have yellow card, Kat.
Like kind of dating my terms there.
No, I only yellow card Chris, and he only yellow cards me, although it's never fair when he does it to me.
Quite true. Very interesting perspective on that. And it's another place where I was thinking about this is that, so Nike really went double down with Colin Kaepernick. Nike said, you know, we support Colin Kaepernick, all these people, oh, we're going to burn our Nikes. And they went, oh yeah. And then they spent more money. And then the revenue went crazy. Like they made so much money supporting Colin Kaepernick. But Adidas did something kind of reasonably interesting, which is that they said, we're not going to get into this fight. We're going to go troll the sea for all kinds of plastic and turn it into shoes. And so they made like 2 million shoes out of sea waste plastic, which of course means, hey, you don't want to enter into the Black Lives Matter conversation. Come over here. We'll just save the earth together. It'll be fine. So I think that was kind of a way to get around that. What's your take?
So that's interesting. The Adidas example, I think, yeah, it's easy to look at it and say, all right, they're choosing to sidestep this other issue that is really in the forefront of everyone's minds. But I think for Adidas, that was I don't know if it was a smart move, but it was certainly an authentic move that aligns with their values. Because back in, I think, 2001, 2002, in there, Adidas was the first company within the footwear industry to publish a corporate social responsibility report to basically say, yeah, we're in an industry that has a lot of problems, particularly in how we interact and how we contribute to the environment. We're a company with a lot of problems, but here's how we're going to start doing things better. And that sort of vulnerable communication, that public accountability of saying, we recognize our impact on the environment, here's how we're going to try to do things better, that really kind of threw down the gauntlet for that industry, for the footwear industry, to say, we've got a lot of problems around child labor, around material sourcing, around environmental impact, global labor relations. What are we all going to do about it? And it caused many more organizations to respond and start to communicate more openly about their efforts. But Adidas spoke out first on the environmental impact, and they've continued to really center that in their corporate social responsibility reporting. So I think in some ways that was, maybe it was a safe move for them, but it was also, it was a wise move for them to continue speaking about those issues. Nobody can call them a dilettante. Nobody can say like, hey, you're new to this problem, because no, they've been focusing on it for a long time. It doesn't make the other problems around Black Lives Matter and policing and whatnot go away, but they are very much staying in their lane.
Do you think that consumers are more cynical than they used to be? I mean, I am very cynical, so for me, it's hard for me to gauge.
Yeah, I think everybody is more cynical than they used to be, but I don't think that we can blame them as marketers, as folks that work with brands, or as fellow consumers and citizens. I think that we are in a society that has been pummeled by gaslighting from politicians and media outlets that support politicians. We've been pummeled on all sides from folks on both sides of the aisle, as well as from brands that kind of align on both sides of the aisle with messages that basically come down to don't believe the evidence of your own eyes. Everybody's out to get you. Everybody's out to make a buck. All politicians lie, except me. So just focus your attention here. And I think that kind of messaging does cause people to become more cynical. When you're hearing, don't believe the evidence of your own eyes, don't believe any sort of personal experience that you've had, that weakens our ability to take in information and have the confidence that we can evaluate its quality, have the confidence that we can determine if it's coming from a good source and maybe weigh it against other information that we already know. Because I think that when we have healthy skepticism, that's when consumers are able to say, well, I don't believe everything at face value, but let me continue to dig. Let me bring in alternate sources of information and kind of weigh what I'm hearing so that I can have a more informed opinion. And I think that kind of skepticism is healthy. That's what smart brands cultivate in their audiences. They tell them, like, here's more information. Look, we're gathering it from multiple places, curating it from multiple sources. Become a more informed consumer. That's skepticism that is healthy. It's cynicism where people wall themselves off from new information. And that, I think that's the thing that brands can start to address, because yeah, we've lost trust in a lot of traditional institutions, in a lot of areas of the government, maybe in the CDC. But the area where people still do have some faith and interest, and certainly interest in hearing more, is from the brands with which they choose to surround themselves. So I think there's a real opportunity for many organizations to wade in and start to rebuild trust with their audiences, start to empower them with better information and access to more information. So I think that's a good point to be.
That is a very good point to be, and it's a good point to pause. Margot Bloomstein, stick around with us. We've got some questions for you in a little panel thereafter. Hang tight. We'll put you backstage. Boop. Hey, that means that I get
now
to do...
Now what? Now we can fit into our orange graphic.
There we go.
Yay!
You're sponsored by the book Content Inc., Joe Pulizzi's new version 2 of Content Inc. Look at that graphic. Isn't that gorgeous?
Edition of the book, which you have at your desk.
It's like, yeah, I don't know what you're talking about. So it's like everything that JP does, top shelf. So we have.
I believe it arrived with cookies. I only heard about them. I didn't receive any.
I feel like this messaging architecture that Joe has created would be Margot approved, but we'll have to ask her that question a little bit later.
I mean, anything with cookies is going to be Carrie approved. That much I know.
So listen, this is important because Margot just got done talking about it too. We're sponsored by Nonfiction, which is a research organization that says that 50% of Americans are frustrated with bias coming from both the left and the right.
How perfect is this for the night Margo is on?
Exactly. SavingAmericansFromTheNews.com is who sponsored us. SavingAmericansFromTheNews.com. Hey, and if you want to look up what the heck that's about, we're sponsored by Presearch. If you don't want to do anything with the big gogola, you could go to presearch.com, which is a completely different search engine, also driven by cryptocurrency. So you could do something really cool there that you can't do on gogola. Instead of buying keywords for exorbitant amounts of money, holders of the Presearch coins get to stake various things. So if Joe wanted to stake best golfer in the world, and when people type that in, it would go to him. You just have to put, you know, your coins where your mouth is and say, I'm going to hold on this one. And you don't have to give away your coins. You just stake them. Presearch.com. I've been using it exclusively for 3+ weeks, except when
But you were logged out, so you didn't get any coin. Yeah, or...
coins. So I finally got logged in with my thing, so I have coins now. Hey, want to make a show like this only slightly better run? We have a streamer, cbrogan.me/streamer. You just build a site, a great video like this. You could do all kinds of live streaming to lots of places. You can make it look almost like a real show. hey, you like
bring your own content experts.
Yes.
Like authors.
All the people. Hey, listen, do you like this show but find us unattractive? Listen to the audio podcast. We're sponsored by Castos. That means you can go anywhere that there are podcasts, type in the Backpack Show. There we are. In fact, you should try that right now on your favorite mobile device with your favorite podcast app and subscribe, even if you never actually listen to an episode there. Subscriber numbers matter. There you go. Say, would you like to have your own .online domain? I mean, who wouldn't? You could have orangeshirt.online. Just go to cbrogan.me/online, put in the code Chris, all caps, And you can get a domain for $1 for an entire year. So you don't even have to wake up with drunken domain purchase regret. You are safe.
It's from just 99 cents or whatever.
Domain purchase.
Now listen, it should be either way they type it in, but it's all caps. So don't forget.
Chris, all caps. Otherwise, it'll cost you $8,000.
No, it won't. Stop
not
really, it.
But, you know, not a buck.
No.
Look at this background. Okay, we have to change it.
It's very cheerful, isn't it? It's a very like cheerful social.
I know. It makes me want to say nice things and kiss animals or something. Fix that quickly. All right, let's get us a Joe. Hi, Joe.
Hello.
That was really quick.
We got ads to do.
Well, I want to say thank you because I know you've been, is this your 150 plus show? And I had to actually pay you to be on the show. So thank you for that.
Well, we've said this now twice. You can't pay to be on the show, it turns out. But we had Colin Pape, who runs pre-search on the show. And we had to tell him, we had to explain the same thing twice because in pre-search sponsored. And then so I start using it because I'm like, well, I probably ought to use what the sponsors do. I liked it so much, but I had so many questions I had to drag him on. But with you, it's a little different. I may have read Content Inc. once. And
we weren't interviewing marketing people for the longest time ever.
Yeah, you're one of a very few marketing people.
You veered away from that.
We talked to dominatrixes and nuns and documentary filmmakers.
Chris, you were in the first version. You're in the second version. Now, Carrie, you're in this one too because, you know, you got the backpack shows in there. So there you go.
Yeah. So, Carrie, you're on page
you just didn't get the
314.
Cookies.
Well, you know, if I have to choose between the two, Joe.
You'd rather cookies.
Than exactly. I'm not sending you the book. I'm just sending you the cookies.
In page 314.
I mean, I got my priorities straight,
Chris Rogan,
you know.
And Carrie Gorgone.
I mean, what better amazing content is there than cookies?
They're amazing.
I'm sorry, Reed, go ahead.
I said, yeah, I called you guys amazing.
Amazing. Then, we got an adjective. It's
and then still, yeah. I called you guys amazing and still couldn't get on the show for free. But yeah, let's not talk even about something. What would you like to talk about?
Yeah. Golf?
Golf, yes. I've got my golf polo on, especially for you.
I love it. So this is the show where Chris does whatever he wants. Like, welcome to the Backpack Show, where we read flattering parts of books about our own show. out loud for you to listen to
whatever gets the ratings, right? I don't know. Does this work? Pandering might work. I don't know.
We'll see.
But yeah,
we don't know how to get ratings.
We were talking before that. So I brought my golf shirt on, and on Monday I golfed 100 holes in one day. It's our big charity event for Orange Effect Foundation. That's the charity we've had since 2014, speech therapy for kids. And it's weird because it wasn't a thing until last year, and pandemic happened and we didn't know what to do. And we were struggling to raise funds. And then Mike Balzano, which is one of our fundraising chairs, said, let's try this 100 hole thing. And, you know, $100,000 later, there it is. I couldn't believe it. So it really worked out well. And we're able to deliver over 1,000 hours of speech therapy for kids who need it. So it was a good event.
Why do you think that went so well? Do you think, you know, people who like golf just have more money? Like, what's the story?
First of all, people right now are very generous, I've found, more than normal. So I want to throw it out to all the people. We had 475 supporters of the event. But I think that it's something unique. It's not the same old that you're trying to, you know, hey, we've got this new thing out or whatever. You've basically got 26 crazy people that decided to go out and golf all day long. We teed off at 6:30 in the morning and ended at 8:30. Some people ended at 9:15. It's just nuts. And when people hear about it, they're like, oh, I'll throw 100 your way. But we try to tie it in and say, oh, look, if you do 250, that gets you 5 hours of speech therapy. And then every twosome, it was a two-person scramble, and every twosome got an Orange Effect kid. So we were supported by, like, I was supported by Will, and we had another one supported by Sarah, who's one of our Orange Effect kids who gets speech therapy. So the team worked it together, and I was really exhausted. I'm still tired, actually. It's 2 days
later.
You
didn't have, like, a stunt player, you can be like, hey, come golf for me. Like the person who books sponsorships for you. Like, hey, you, book a sponsorship for me.
The peasant that you called before the show. Like, does he have a peasant that pays for things like
that? You
this?
There, girl, go and play golf for me.
Please go.
It's for the kids.
Yeah, this is a kid-friendly show, right? So yeah.
You know, anyway. Ostensibly.
Yeah. Well,
we never anyways, know.
But yes, it was a great outing, and we'll probably do it again because it seems to work, and yeah, it's fun.
You know, we kind of know each other's stuff, or like in our space, we kind of know what each other's doing. Yep. We don't always know what each other's doing, and we kind of like smile play, like, hey, you're probably doing some things. And you mm-hmm. you say that at like hallways when you see each other for the 31 seconds you see each other. I've looked at this book twice. I didn't like, you know, pour through it. Although the first time I read it, I was on an airplane. So it was a really like, you know, one of those reads where you don't move. But I wanted you to talk a little bit about the content tilt, because I mean, clearly the concept and the term and everything matters to you. Because you have your tilt site, you have your tilt crypto coin. The concept matters to you maybe more than the others. And maybe at one point this book almost got called something about the tilt, because I get that feeling. I get that feeling like that's the anchor of this book and everything else supports it.
You know, it's yes, you are correct. You're very observant, Chris. That's a key part. And I always say to everyone, you can do all seven steps of the Content Inc. model, but if you don't have the content tilt, it's not going to work for you. You're not going to build an audience. You're not going to sell more products and services. You're not going to build a community. And so, and it actually comes from the Matrix. I don't know if you're a Matrix fan. I'm a big Keanu Reeves Matrix fan. And the point where, you know, Neo, who Keanu Reeves' character, who's the one, goes in and there's the little boy there who's bending the spoons and keeps bending the spoons. And Neo leans down and looks and can't bend that spoon. And then the boy says, well, there is no spoon. And then Neo tilts his head and looks at the spoon differently. And I don't know what it was, like a lightning bolt hit me. And I'm like, oh, that, yes, he looks at it differently and everything changes. And I said, well, that's what we don't do with our content creation. Basically, we take it at face value and we're like, oh, we're just going to talk about what everybody else talks about. Actually, a lot like Margo was just talking about. But you have to find an area of little to no competition on the web where you can actually break through all the content clutter. Because everyone says, oh, there's so much clutter out there. Well, there's as much clutter as there's ever been since the dawn of the printing press. But what you have to do is see if there's an opportunity somewhere to tell a unique story, a differentiated story, and break through, have a point of view, and then you can do all the other things and build the audience and do social media and search and whatever. So, yeah, I think that's really important. It's part of strategy, sweet spot, content tilt. That's where you spend your time figuring out, you know, who am I going to communicate with? Why does it even matter? And then you get to the what a little bit later, because you really have to find out, why are you doing this in the first place? And that's all about your content tilt.
So why revisit a book you've already written? Is it because you've discovered new things you want to talk about? Or was your publisher just like, seriously, though, we need to make more money off this book?
No, I'll tell you,
Carrie. Chris makes it sound.
You could have been that second one. No, you want to know what it is? What it was here is I was writing mystery novels. Like I left Content Marketing Institute. My wife and I own Content Marketing Institute. We sold in 2016. I stayed until the end of 17. I took a sabbatical year in 2018. And then I actually wanted to write something that my wife would actually read. And she reads mysteries and thrillers. And she's never read any of my marketing books, and except for the acknowledgments. She wants to see what I say about her. You know, okay. But I'm like, I would really like to write something that she likes. So I'm like, okay, I'll write this thing. First of all, it's much more difficult to write a mystery thriller than to write a business book for me personally. So fits and starts. 2019, I wrote a thriller called The Will to Die. It did fairly well, won a couple of awards. It sold, you know, it did okay. I was pretty, and I said, I think this could be my next career. This is my move. I started on the second version of The Will to Die right after, it was about March 12th, I don't know, of 2020. I don't know if you remember what was going on about that time, but it was lockdown. Nope. Time.
Locked it right out.
It was, yeah. So everything changed. And about a month later, I start getting messages. You know, a lot of our colleagues were hurting, you know, laid off of work. We didn't know uncertainty what was going to go on. And so they started reaching out to me, direct messages, texts, whatever, saying, Joe, is this Content Inc. model, is this still relevant? Because I'm going to start a business and I want to build an audience and this is a thing. And then I started to look at some of the analytics we have, and the page views were up on the site that I've ignored for years, and the podcast that I stopped producing for 2 years, the downloads were going up. And I'm like, this is weird. So I called Danya, my executive editor at McGraw-Hill Education. I said, Danya, can you look at this stuff? Am I, is this crazy? Like, are people actually engaging in this content that's 5-6 years old now. And she says, yeah, I see it too. Let's do another version. So from that moment on, I said, okay, I think I can be more valuable to the world right now by not writing another thriller. Let's focus on Content Inc. So rewrote that. We did all new case studies, global this time, thankfully, updated the model, made sure that it actually worked. And I actually put in the
whole— market your books, market your mystery books. You can market the hell out of those mystery books, bro. Come on.
Yeah, I know.
Eat your own dog food.
It's crazy. So then I couldn't just leave that the book thing. So I said, well, let's start another business. So this is my fourth business, thetilt.com, which is an email newsletter dedicated to content creators who want to build sustainable businesses. So that's my mission right now, is to focus on content creators with the book and everything else we're doing. And of course the Tilt creator coin that I'm 100% into, and you know, just trying to figure things out.
So I got to ask about the newsletter thing, only because also, I purchased, I haven't bought a newsletter in my life, and I bought Sam Parr's The Trends, trends.co
that
he has.
Sure.
Well, Sam is also the guy who sold The Hustle to HubSpot for $1.5 million. And I had tweeted something about loving his newsletter, and he like retweeted me, and I kind of pooped my pants. I was like, he saw me, notice me, senpai. Is that part of the reasoning behind the Tilt? Because you went, whoa, wait a minute, there's a little bit of gold here. If people get a little smarter about things like newsletters, is that why this fourth business came about?
Well, the focus on the content creator, that I'm frustrated right now with a lot of the things that are going on in the, you know, creator economy, if you want to use that term, because they're so platform focused. Twitter and Twitch and YouTube, they're all basically saying, oh, we love you, creator, come live on my platform, we'll throw all kinds of revenue opportunities to you, which is fine, and I like what they're doing. It's also very seductive, and I don't want a lot of entrepreneurs to get stuck in whenever they change the rules, which they always do. You know, like Substack's a good example. I like Substack. I like what they've done with e-newsletters there, but they don't really send you any more traffic, and you sort of do get caught in their platform, and it's hard to move. So I like making sure you're more— I mean, I'm a big decentralized fan. You've been talking about this on the show. So I want to go that direction. So I really wanted to see that happen. And then the other thing with the e-newsletter, I like this. If I can have my choice, I want to start on a platform I have more control over. And that if I can get the permission of an audience to opt in, I want to start there. Yes. Could I start on YouTube? Could I start on a podcast? Could I start on a Twitch channel and maybe be more successful? I don't know. Maybe not. The audience is already there. I got to work harder in email, but I don't have to then have a secondary strategy to move those people off those platforms to get them into email. We're starting with the hardest part first. So yeah, I'm a big believer. I think that I'm still as bullish on email as I was in 2013 at Social Media Marketing World, when I'm on stage telling everybody, forget social media, go to email, and they're booing me. And I'm like, no, really, email is— I mean, it's still the thing. It's— if you're telling me which channel I would focus on right now more than any other, sorry, opt in email. That's where I'm at.
For real.
Yep. So
people don't want to hear it,
or a show, or a show on, you know, using StreamYard technology and being able to syndicate to multiple places at the same time. That would be a close second.
Well, listen.
Very diplomatic of you, Joe.
You know that,
but I still want cookies.
Oh, you'll get them.
You don't listen. He's thought about that four times already.
Oh yeah. Well, I don't know what kind of cookies you want.
Are you kidding? If there's anything else but chocolate, it's a waste of time.
Oh, but you want chocolate or decadent? We have chocolate and decadent chocolate.
Hey, listen. I'm not fussy as long as it's chocolate.
Okay.
I received decadent chocolate, just so you know, and it was delicious.
Well, whichever one's better than that?
I think it was— I think Margot said— I'm talking out of school here, but I thought Margot said if there's decadent chocolate, that's the only choice. Somebody said that. Like, how can you— but you can one up chocolate with decadent. Yeah, she did. So she said
she did. Okay.
Yeah.
Normally presented with choices, one involves chocolate and one involves like raisins, and for me that is not a difficult choice, is what I'm saying. So
by the way, just
chocolate involved, I'm in.
Just a tip for people with books or doing giveaways or whatever. We did the whole book cookie thing, and we had like a 95% return rate on that. by the way, you're from very busy, important people. And I'm like, and it was, by the way, it's my wife's idea. It's totally hers. I can't take credit
for
it.
Well, how about that? We're talking about it at length, and I didn't even get any cookies. Like, that's how much we're talking about. Well, I'm like, That is a remarkable thing.
It's great, but here's the problem. On social media sharing, everyone's talking about the cookies, and then, oh, by the way, Joe launched a book. I'm like, okay, well, you know, whatever it takes.
So what's new in the book? What's an unexpected treat people will find in the book?
Well,
if there's not cookies.
We go through the different revenue types, which is a little bit of an adaptation because so much has changed, so much with the social platforms. But a lot of the focus in this book is, first of all, making sure you've got the right goals when you start this thing off, like any entrepreneur should, but also that you plan for an exit from the beginning. And then when you get to the point where you might want to exit, we go through that process of, okay, do you want to be a big enterprise? Do you want to grow into something larger than you are right now? How do you staff that? How do you scale that? Or do you want to sell? And so I basically go through multiple cases, including my own, of, you know, how we sold the company, how you look at that, how you look at multiples, what your business is worth. And what we found out looking at all the case studies is, in about five, if you do it right, you focus on one audience, you find your content tilt, in 5 years, you should have around a $5 million valuation. And that's what we've sort of found. And I love that. The problem is with the model, you get crickets for the first 2 years. I mean, literally, there's nothing. I mean, it's very difficult, as you know, to build an audience. It takes you generally. I mean, I had an interview with Brian Clark today, and I said, when you started, from when you had your first dollar in revenue, how long did it take? He said 18 months. I talked to the team at teachbetter.com, which is now a multi-million dollar educational platform. I said, how long from when you started till you had a big enough audience to generate revenue? They said 18 months. Mine was 22 months. So that's the thing, is once you can get past that barrier of, okay, we're figuring out the model. We know we're becoming this, you know, loyal, trusted arm for a bunch of, for a community, for an audience. Then you make it to the point where, oh, I can generate revenue. And then you do a hockey stick. So that's generally what we see. You make it to the 2 year mark, sky's the limit. And you're seeing exits like The Hustle, that just sold to HubSpot for a bunch of money, or like Morning Brew.
Right.
So the thing is that most people stop after 6-9 months and they think they can build an audience in that amount of time. And you can win the lottery, but it's hard to do.
And it is a lot of lot like a lottery in some ways. And I'll throw one other hint in there for free. Don't keep changing what you feel like talking about 90 degrees every few months, because then you could take 16 years and still not have that, you know, monetization and exit. Mm-hmm. It turns out, just math.
Well, I mean, and you know, we've been, how many conferences have you and I been together? And you,
all of them.
If you, when you like walk by, you don't stay for my presentation, but you generally walk by and at least see what I'm talking about. They're always the same. I've had the same presentation for 10 years. I think Content Tilt has been in every presentation, and you just keep reworking it. You're working on it. I'm still trying to perfect that presentation, but you know, still focused on the same kind of audience, still focused on the same kind of thing. You just try to reinvent yourself and make sure you're relevant and talking about the right things.
I talk about law. He didn't even stay for mine. He just like wandered off. Thanks, Christopher.
And he took your cookies.
Too. I took right, and then he's like, "Oh no, I have law questions. I better carry it home.
Better help." Something you said about that, though, it's really funny. There's kind of two people. There's somebody who's, you know, they write their book, they rewrite their book. I trust agents 10th anniversary, so like I'm not throwing any rocks. But there's people who are known for that one big idea their entire career. And anytime they veer and write another book, that goes nowhere, never goes anywhere. You know what I mean? Book yourself solid. Poor Stelzner. I mean, Michael Port. I don't know why I said Stelzner. He's on my head. Michael Port. He's written like five other books. I love three of those other books more than I like Book Yourself Solid, but he's always-
Joe has other books, you know, Killing Marketing, Epic Content Marketing.
Killing Marketing is a great book.
So Epic Content Marketing came out in 2013, and that one did really well because content marketing was just taking off, and it was sort of the frenzy of, if there was such a thing, the frenzy of content marketing, and that became the book for content marketing. So great, I'm glad. Content Marketing has been, Content Inc. has been the best performer. Killing Marketing was tough. It's to an enterprise crowd. It's to a different audience. It's, but the one I wanted to do the best was The Will to Die, my mystery, which when you focus on marketers and entrepreneurs your entire career, and then you're trying to build an audience of mystery lovers, it's depressing. It's depressing. That's why you need
beer.
Well, and you know, this. I'm sure you've had other writers on that write fiction. It takes about 3 books. I mean, you have to build. You have to do it consistently over a long period of time. I mean, if you look at whether it's Lee Child or John Grisham, it took them a couple books to get going, and then people come back to the first book. So that's with anything, right? That's with if you do a podcast, an email, a book, whatever, you have to do it consistently over a long period of time, and then things start to work for you. There's no one-hit wonders in my book. So.
Name drop incoming. Lee Child is a super nice person. I met him at a little bookstore.
I've heard
that. He was a super sweet guy. He's 6'4". I'm 6'2". He was towering over people in the store. It was really grand.
He's got a really good thing on his site, though, and he says, because he's got people coming to him all the time with ideas, and he said, anyone that has a really good mystery thriller idea, keep it for yourself and write it yourself. Don't tell your own story. And I'm like, that's pretty good advice.
We've had several authors on, and what they all had in common is that they had another career before, like, I mean, complete and total careers. Like, one had a law career, Robert McCaw, and then started writing mystery books after he retired about Hawaii because he loves Hawaii and he's got like a house there and fell in love with the culture and stuff. So that's his thing. Len Joy had a manufacturing business. I mean, for decades, sold it, became a triathlete, like on the national team, and started writing books, award-winning sports fiction books. Right. So I just love that idea. Like, if you do have an idea for a mystery novel or any other type of fiction book or anything else, it's never too late. So keep that idea for yourself. Don't give up on it.
And I know so many people that have the, you know, the idea in the desk drawer kind of a thing, or they've written some of it. And I've talked to a lot of them recently, especially with writing the mystery. And I'm like, just finish it. Spend 4 weeks and write for an hour every day and get it to a point. That's what I had to do. I basically, after a lot of fits and starts, it was really took me 4 weeks to write the first draft, but I had to spend 1 to 2 hours a day and just get into that rhythm, because the first 10 days were just terrible.
Like, was your wife supportive when you switched back to Content Inc, or was she like slamming pots around and like making loud phone calls, sending people in for stuff when you switched back to content marketing?
So to be honest with, not a lot of people know this, but when I told her that I was going to start the business and write the book again, she was not happy at all. She's like, are you kidding me? Our kids are finally going off to college now, and we can finally travel. The pandemic's ending and we can do these things. And you just started a new business. Are you kidding me? And I'm like, I still love you. It's not personal. I have a problem. I just start businesses and I can't stop. So I don't know what to do. But
well, let's ask Margo.
It's an issue.
All right, Margo, what do we do?
Cookies. Start with baking them for your wife.
That's good advice.
No, she said that she would not work in the business this time. So And she's very smart to do that.
So you were like, buy me a sponsorship. She's like, go to hell.
Like, get out of here.
You're yourself.
I hate you. I can't stand you. Go do something. So, Hi, Margo. How are you?
Good. How are you? Congratulations.
Congratulations on your book.
Books.
I just got a wonder. I got to show it because, you know, proof and whatever. I just got this beautiful book. I'm so excited. I have read a lot of it already, but I'm looking forward to finishing it. And it's so funny. I mean, Chris and Carrie, you don't know this, but Margo and I have known each other for over 10 years now, running into each other at Content Strategy. By the way, Chris, you asked a really good question, because so I would go to marketing events and content marketing events, and Margo would be speaking at Content Strategy events. And when I started out in the business, I thought they were, close to the same. They're not. Content Strategy people are much smarter and way more intelligent. And when I'm at a Content Strategy conference, I'm very confused. I don't really know what's going on. They're talking about, meta things and architecture this, and I'm in marketing and publishing. I really don't know what you're talking about, but
we need smart. Both sides of the coin, though. Like, I always feel like content strategy and content marketing is how you execute, one way of executing on content strategy. So we may be nerdy, but thank you on the content marketing side for helping to make it real.
Well, but you gotta, I mean, you know, this content strategy is a part of all divisions of the company. I mean, because every portion of every company is creating some kind of content, and they need to understand that, and they need to have governance over it. You can have content strategy for marketing, but you have to have it for everybody else in the organization. A lot of people don't realize that, but you've done a great job, Margo, because you can talk both sides of that. And when I go to a content strategy conference, sometimes I'll be talking to somebody that's talking about tagging this and doing that, and anything to do with governance is not my thing. And I have to leave. I have to say, I'm sorry. I have to go get a drink or something. They're pleasant people.
I like to think that I can sing karaoke with people at all different types of companies.
That's true.
So this has only happened maybe two other times that I've thought Chris and I could just peace out and you guys could run the show. And then we could have the orange graphic. It would be perfect.
Honestly, I don't think Margo and I have caught. It's probably been 5 years since we actually caught up and we had coffee somewhere, just chit chatting about stuff. I mean, two can go and we'll just
shut the lights out when you're done.
We got it.
Exactly. No, we're sorry. You have it back. You have the con.
Oh no, don't be sorry. We were enjoying ourselves, but thank you. Chris would be like, oh, thank you for letting me run my show.
Although, when you were saying about how your wife doesn't want to have anything to do with the business, I was thinking about that Flynn kid and the fact that he's got all his kids making content for him now. They all stream together and all that sort of thing. That Patrick Flynn boy.
My kids will not have anything to do with marketing. They're like, nope.
Oh, my youngest just, I walk around him and he just says, boomer. And I'm like, I'm not a boomer, man.
Gen X, the forgotten generation.
But then he says, boomer is not an age. Boomer is a mentality. You have it. I'm just like, why did I have kids?
Keep in mind, your ass is broke. Everything you see is mine. So
exactly.
Calling out people and being critical of their life choices, isn't that the most boomer thing of all? I think your son's a boomer. He's a boomer.
Oh yeah, he would love to have a conversation with you right now. He would. I'm sure he means it in the best possible way, and I'm sure he still loves me.
Well, obviously he loves you, but I'm not so sure he means it way. Two things are not related.
Yeah, it's an issue. It's an issue. But you know what? They're both my kids are off to college in the fall. So at the same time, which will be wonderful.
Expensive.
The key word.
The one you like better is going to a private school and the other one's going to community college because you're bills.
How did you know this? Absolutely. No. I love them both the same, just in different ways.
It just happened that one went to community college.
Exactly.
Got you.
You do what you got to do to survive.
Who's our person of the day, Chris? I don't even know.
I'm so lost at this point.
Margo, we're never allowed back on the show after this.
I mean, not together. We'll wait till your next
separate you or something.
And we'll separate you two.
Hang on a minute.
Oh, and here's our person of the day. Kaboom!
So every now and again, thank you, Apple Macintosh, sort of 2015 MacBook Pro. Every now and again, when I go to push the video asset on this show, it just goes really slow on my side. So I always hope, I hope it looks right for you.
It's fine. Who do you want?
That's a great, what do we got places to be? Hang on a second.
No, I just want to know. I never know. I don't pick the person of the day. You pick the person of the day. I'm as excited as anybody else.
I'll bring our troll forward. I will say our friend Chip Griffin. He's been doing stupid umpiring for some reason. What's their baseball? There's a thunderstorm out there, Griffin. Did you call anything on rain today?
Ooh.
So you're our person of the day.
I don't think Griffin likes that you went to the evening slot.
I think you're right.
Everybody's got an opinion. We have some folks in Scotland and Italy who are very annoyed.
And my parents are not cheery about it. My parents said, we have lots of things to do, mister.
But they were significantly less cheery when it was for their, 6 in the
7
morning?
7 a.m.? Yeah, they're morning. 6 of them to watch the dumb show. But
I mean, they didn't like that. Congratulations, Chip.
I actually have a solution for you. I think you need to do two shows a day.
I think you're right.
Because is this Vegas?
Yes, that's what you'll satisfy everyone.
Who is the Celine Dion of StreamYard if not this show?
Feathers. Don't tell Chris he needs to do another show. Margo, will do it.
Another show, but you switch sides. You're on other. It's the backward backpack show.
Oh, I'm sorry. It'd be like a whole different show. Ooh. He's got, look, he's got what this show. He's got this show.
That's pretty good.
This show.
Oh, you can only see the little edge.
All the shows.
Oh, that's pretty
But
nice.
It's enough. He got different branding for every show. He's got shows for days.
Wow.
I've got the scratch pad. I've got the modern business show. And I have what I'm calling a 10-minute keynote, which I haven't launched yet.
Wow. And then there's things that aren't even shows where he's just like, I'm just going to write a blog post if anybody wants to come watch. And people do. It's
like 10-minute keynote is a show for people whose head is too long. That's what I'm going for there.
That's a niche. I think you got
that's my
there.
Kill. I was like, you have that. You know what's too long? Lord. Head. Because that's the other way you can get that tilt is when people look at you like a big.
What is it? What
idiot.
Is a TED Talk 14 20? Or 16
18.
Minutes?
18.
18. Oh, it's 18. Oh, wow. Right, that is long. That, well, yeah. I think that you should go 9. You can't go 10. You got to split the difference.
I like your idea there. And I'm going to take it under advisement.
Yeah, because so I think
instead of ideas worth spreading, this is like ideas worth splitting.
Ideas worth mentioning.
Yeah,
you can't get this branding advice.
Like ideas worth editing.
Oh, I'm also putting
ideas for which you need Tamsin Webster's help to turn into a TED Talk. Yeah.
I'm also putting the Celine Dion of StreamYard on my business card, so just look around for that.
Margo. Oh, that's nice.
I think that's
you
a win.
Have business cards? You don't.
I well, not anymore. But you know what? I had business cards for a long, long time that all they said on them was "stop talking." And so somebody would be talking to me at a conference or something, and I would just hand it to somebody. I go, "Can I give you my card?"
You're mean.
That's good.
Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah, we all need some of those.
I got those, and they were so great.
It was really funny. Somebody gave it back to you.
Yes.
They ripped it in half and gave it back to you.
You know,
they split it.
Threw it on the ground.
They that edited, reminds me of they something. They edited your card.
Oh, for God's sake, stop talking. Let the woman speak.
Thank you.
Right. So we got to go to the person. I mean, we did person today. We got to go to the backpack. So here's a question we've asked every guest in the world from Butterscotch, 5-time World Beatboxing Championship. We have
our Mix-a-Lot. Mix-a-Lot. Sister Anne
Flanagan. I was trying to think of what was our financial dominatrix's name? Mistress what?
Harley.
Mistress Harley. Yep. She's answered this. So here's the thing. It could be something physical. It could be something metaphorical. Carrie, what's a great example of a physical thing you could throw in a backpack?
Ooh, extra set of teeth.
An extra set of teeth.
DJ Cumberbund. That's like my perennial favorite.
Oh, great answer. What about something metaphorical someone could put in a backpack? What do you got? I don't want to stump you.
Kindness?
Oh, that's maybe a good one.
Kindness. Ariel Helvetica, our burlesque performer.
Yep.
She said kindness.
She did it. All right, Margo Bloomstein, what is something we should be throwing into our backpack?
Oh man, that extra set of teeth. That's
right. Like, I mean, yeah, just I never like know.
Yeah, I feel like that is like up there though with like what's the first thing that you ask a genie for? More wishes, unlimited wishes. An extra backpack. I think the thing that I would want to have with me, I guess it's kind of both tactical and sort of metaphysical and kind of my big thing during the pandemic, gummy vitamins. Like I switched from not being somebody that took vitamins to now taking vitamins. And then I was like, I'm going to have gummy vitamins because they always taste like candy. And yeah, you're doing a good thing, but you're also like, now I'm having candy first thing in the morning. And it just sets you off really well for the rest of the day. So gummy vitamins.
I guess it also depends if you mean gummy vitamins or gummy vitamins. Because I have gummy vitamins when I'm having anxiety attacks. But
no, these are like vitamin D and vitamin C, and it's fabulous. Super. So yeah, I say gummy vitamins.
Joe Pulizzi, author again of Content Inc.
Again,
what goes in the backpack?
I'll be serious because I've been joking the whole time, and I have it right here. I have one of them. So this is my little orange notebook. I have about 77 of them just laying around here, and I write everything down. And I'm a big goal setter, and I'm a big goal reviewer. So every day I write things down. I review them. If I have long-term goals, I review those. And if you do it in the morning, you sort of set your day by here's what I want to accomplish, and here's the things I shouldn't be doing. So And for some reason, I have to write things down. I can't. I'm not a note taker by typing
digitally. Whatever. Yeah.
Yep. So that's my jam.
I hear that. Well, I have something to tell you about cookies. That my grandmother was an incredible cook of Whole House cookies, and so Chris's grandmother.
You said Chris's grandmother is in my backpack. Jane, your mom is in my backpack.
Grandmother should stop talking first. Wow, have we primed this crowd? My gosh. So my grandmother made Toll House cookies every time we visited, but she did this trick because my favorite food was leftovers. And so she would take just one square of whatever out so that you would think that it was leftovers. But why did I ever not get that it was just one square? This is what I think maybe she was trying to get.
Wise.